The British radio has just reported that every plane in the vast fleet of American transport aircraft that flew with troops and equipment onto the continent was painted with broad blue and white stripes and carried colored lights, yet no fighters or heavy flak opposed it. The huge, brilliantly lighted armada stretched for more than 250 miles, continued the broadcast, which was recorded here at the CBS shortwave listening station. It traveled only a few hundred feet above the ground, and it took more than an hour to pass. It met only small arms fire, mostly from 50 caliber machine guns. Here is a late bulletin with a dateline Folkestone, England on it. It says, German guns across the English Channel opened fire at 5 p.m. today for the second time since the invasion began, but ceased as soon as Royal Air Force planes appeared over them. That is, of course, 5 p.m. English time, which would be 11 a.m. New York time. Penetrations several miles inland were made by American, British, and Canadian troops, which poured into northern France by air and sea in overwhelming strength and established firm fighting fronts in the first stage of the battle for Europe. That is, in essence, a summary of what Prime Minister Churchill said in his report to the Commons. Mr. Churchill, in his second appearance of the day before the House of Commons, gave this stirring report of the invasion. The supreme headquarters of General Dwight D. Eisenhower's Allied Expeditionary Forces added to Churchill's summary by disclosing that the first, in a series of four or five obstacles in the way of Europe's liberation, has now been overcome. Disclosing that enemy opposition was less than anticipated and that coastal defenses were weakened into virtual uselessness by air and naval bombardment, Churchill said our airborne troops are well established and our follow-ups are all proceeding with very much less loss than we expected. Fighting, he said, is proceeding at various points. We have captured various bridges, which are of importance and which are not blown up. There even is fighting proceeding in the town of Caen. That's spelled C-A-E-N, of course. All of this, although very valuable, is a first and vitally essential step, but it gives no indication whatever of what may be the course of the battle in the next few days or weeks, because the enemy will not probably endeavor to concentrate in this area. Here is more detail on the American leader's report to President Roosevelt. Admiral King, you'll remember, came out of the White House a little while ago and seemed to be very happy about the progress of the invasion. Admiral King was at the D-Day conference with the president, together with General George C. Marshall, Army Chief of Staff, and General Henry H. Arnold, the Chief of the United States Army Air Forces. The three top flight leaders of America's military might emerged from their conference with President Roosevelt smiling and in apparent good humor. General Marshall was asked if he could say anything about the progress of the Allied landings, and he replied, "I'd rather not," but he smiled with evident satisfaction. Admiral King then said, "It's doing all right so far." President Roosevelt called the officers to the White House a few hours before, and he will go on the radio to lead the American people in prayer for success of the Allied liberation of Europe. Now, evidently, the airborne troops, which would mean paratroopers, glider-borne troops, and transport troops, have played a very major part in the securing of beachheads in Hitler's Europe. And here, a United Press correspondent who has just returned to England after riding on a 9th Air Force troop carrier plane, which dropped American paratroopers on France, tells his story. It's an eyewitness description. He says American parachute infantry, spilling from troop carrier planes with deadly stealth, apparently caught German defenses by surprise before dawn and struck the first American blow at selected targets in Normandy. Thousands of paratroopers were dropped dead on targets by hundreds of Dakota carrier planes operating in three wings from myriad bases in Britain. The surprise, he says, was shown in the lack of opposition to the first plane arriving over the drop zone and the moderate and inaccurate flak encountered by those which followed. Night fighter opposition was negligible, although the big C-47s and C-53s, which carried up to 18 men each, were escorted by Allied night fighters and intruders. The huge planes roared off from their bases in the dead of night, and a few hours later returned with one of the lightest casualty lists ever reported for an operation of such magnitude. The weather favored the paratroopers. The planes were able to drop below an undercast directly over the drop spots. And while the American paratroopers hit at German communications, airfields, supply dumps, and command points, British airborne units were striking farther along the French coast. Brigadier General Paul L. Williams, whose troop carriers led the invasion of Sicily, congratulated all wings in his command on the successful execution of their missions. Few crews reported difficulties. Lieutenant Arthur T. Douglas of New Orleans, who brought his Dakota over the drop zone in one of the later groups, encountered heavy ground fire, which made it impossible to drop his paratroopers on the first run. He made three runs in all before dropping his human cargo. When we approached the drop zone, Douglas said, it appeared circled with machine gun fire and light flak which formed a crossfire. The bullets sounded like rain on a tin roof. We made one run, but nobody could jump. And as I started away from the target, the crew chief told me about it. We were going out over the channel, but I swung the plane around and went back over the drop zone again, trying to get under the trajectory of ground fire. That time, most of the men jumped, but there still were some unable to get away. Flak burst near us and threw three men to the floor, so we circled and went back a third time. Bullets were whizzing all around the plane and cutting it up, so when I got rid of my stick, I went to the deck and got out of range. When he says he went to the deck, of course it means he went right down as close to the ground as he could get. Major Howard W. Cannon of St. George, Utah, who was co-pilot of the lead plane, said that his crew saw fires burning furiously near the drop zone, apparently started by preparatory bombings. They looked like barrels of oil going up, is the way Major Cannon described it. His plane encountered some gunfire going over the Channel Islands, but it was ineffective, he said. Lieutenant Jack H. Smith of Hot Springs, Arkansas, saw one transport shot down. He says that we had passed the drop zone when we saw a blue, pulsating flash from the plane ahead of us. We followed the burning flyer down. He went down gamely. But before he hit the drink, we saw five parachutes blossom out of the plane. That was the report of a United Press correspondent who went over Europe with American parachute troops this morning when the invasion started. America, here at home, we seem to have received the news of the invasion of Europe very calmly and then turned to the altars of our faiths to pray for peace with victory. In the nation's hamlets and in the great cities, people went to churches, temples, and synagogues to meditate and to participate in the services of prayer scheduled for D-Day. There were few demonstrations. Groups gathered at newsstands and stood before radio loudspeakers. Comment generally reflected the combination of hope and trepidation which marked the end of a tense waiting period. I've just come up to New York from Washington, and on the way up I noticed in the railroad stations that the people stood very quietly and read their newspapers. Even here in New York, in the subways, instead of glancing at the front page and then running to the sports page, people were sitting quietly and reading the latest details of the invasion from their papers, and sometimes on the stations you saw them portable radio which was giving the latest news as they stood there. The people have been quiet. Perhaps they've tasted so often of this invasion that they now understand that just securing a beachhead doesn't mean the battle is won. They know that the days ahead of us are going to be just as difficult as those hours which followed immediately after H hour on D-Day, which is today. Thousands of men and women in war production plants observed a brief moment of silence, followed by an immediate resumption of the flow of materials of war. Plant officials announced uniformly and proudly that the announcement came without a slackening of output. Here in New York, a public prayer observance to be held at 5:30 p.m. this afternoon at the Madison Square Eternal Light World War I Memorial was announced, and ceremonies which will be repeated in communities in all parts of the country. Some cities, such as Albuquerque, New Mexico, announced D-Day and H-Hour with sirens and whistles, summoning men and women to their places of worship. At the United States Veterans Hospital in here in New York, 1,800 men, still hospitalized 25 years after World War I, were given the news by nurses. Patients in pajamas and bathrobes, walking on crutches and canes, gathered in the hospital lawns and bowed in silent prayer. Newspapers issued extras all over the country, and radio broadcasting companies such as our CBS pushed all scheduled programs aside to bring you the news. The New York Stock Exchange halted its activities for a two-minute prayer period. Emergency orders for augmented personnel went out from the nation's telephone companies. As American servicemen accepted the news in their stride, a light note was struck by a group of French sailors in New York who linked arms and joyously danced down Broadway. That also happened in Philadelphia. I brought a new Philadelphia paper up with me, and they described there French sailors munching donuts in the Salvation Army canteen in City Hall Plaza, looking up when the women volunteer told them that paratroopers were landing in France. She had no way of knowing what the sailors thought, but she did notice that they gulped their coffee and swung across the plaza toward a subway entrance and their ships. The major racetracks suspended their programs, but generally sports events went on as scheduled. Virginia civilian defense officials sent over the civilian air raid warning system, a summons to 8 p.m. prayer meetings in all the cities and most of the towns. Here in New York, Lord & Taylor, a specialty shop, closed for the day, and its 3,000 employees were given the day off to pray and hope for victory. Now we have a bulletin here from New York which gives us further details on the young British girl, Joan Ellis, who sent through the false flash 3 days ago announcing the opening of the European invasion. Joan Ellis, it says, the 22-year-old British teletype operator who sent that false flash 3 days ago, reporting the European invasion, was very happily remembered by newspaper editors when D-Day finally arrived. The newsmen here found time to message expressions of agreement with James P. Rosemond, who was the managing editor of the Akron, Ohio Beacon Journal. He said, based on Joan Ellis's statement, asking America to forgive me, suggests AP editors cable message to her. Ours would be, no one in Ohio concerned about invasion flash, good luck and carry on. That message was forwarded to the London Bureau of the Associated Press. Tell the British girl who flashed the invasion Saturday that we all love her and that she scooped the world, said the Mayfield, Kentucky messenger. The South Bend, Indiana Tribune messaged, please cable Joan Ellis that Indiana thinks you knew it all the time. Comments such as these came from all parts of the country, and perhaps Joan Ellis did a great good deed for her country, for we know now that great fleets loaded down with troops and having all the semblance of a full-blown invasion have sailed repeatedly up and down the coast of France. They've had the Germans in tenterhooks and time again sent them to their bastions of defense only to find it was a false alarm. General Eisenhower this time played another one of his wonderful tricks on the enemy. Watching past performances of invasions, I saw some of them in the Mediterranean myself, they got used to the idea that General Eisenhower never invaded unless the moon was waxing, was new, that the tides were high, and the H hour always came between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning. This time, General Eisenhower let the moon go its way, let the tides pretty much go their way, and struck in daylight, probably accounting for the surprise of the Germans. Here is a late report from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces in England. More than 10,000 tons of explosives, it says, were showered on invasion coastal targets by an estimated 31,000 airmen in the 8-hour period between midnight yesterday and 8 a.m. today. Spearheading the tremendous aerial armadas which by night and day blasted a path for the invading ground forces was a giant formation of well over 1,000 RAF Lancaster and Halifax bombers, which last night dropped 5,600 or more American tons of bombs on 10 Nazi gun batteries. Remember that the Lancaster and the Halifax are the great British bombers, which have roared out over Germany these 2 or 3 years past and can carry great loads. They are the planes that usually drop the great blockbusters weighing 8,000 pounds and even 12,000 pounds. The resistance of the batteries, that's enemy batteries, has been greatly weakened by the bombing of the Air Force and the superior bombardment of our ships quickly reduced the fire of these batteries to dimensions which did not affect the problem. That is what headquarters announced, giving us one of the clear-cut indications of the reasons for the success of our initial efforts in the liberation of Europe. The estimate of 31,000 airmen in action, made by well-informed observers, did not include airborne troops. Now, the well-informed observer in England is undoubtedly a capable army officer who is giving on-the-record background to guide the correspondents in their reports. We find now that the Japanese people have at last been informed of the Allied invasion of northern France. Don Mosley, our correspondent, the CBS correspondent in San Francisco, reports that Radio Tokyo has declined to editorialize in any manner concerning the success or failure of the operation. However, not a single Japanese comment has reached the Nipponese people themselves, and all Radio Tokyo remarks have been almost verbatim reports of German communiques. Apparently, the Japs are playing it very cautious this morning, paying lip service to their Nazi comrades, but avoiding any firm propaganda line lest they find themselves out on a mighty weak limb. Meantime, a Mr. Ushiba, former secretary of the Japanese embassy in Berlin, said, it is not only the German high command, but also the entire German people on the home front who have been itching for this moment, because their conviction is that the enemy's European invasion is the long-awaited signal to touch off the pent-up strength of the German Wehrmacht to deal a most decisive blow to the enemy. Then Ushiba, in a sweeping remark, added his conclusion that now the Allies are walking into a death trap laid by the German high command. However, such a comment has not been told the Japs themselves. That gives us a fundamental idea of the kind of Japanese propaganda that is going out to the people of Japan. I don't think that these reports from Japan necessarily indicate that the Japanese have any faith in the ability of their Axis comrades to hold the Hitler fortress of Europe. They must appreciate already that the beaches are secured. Here is a flash from Reuters in London, which says many secret weapons were used for the first time by the liberating armies in the invasion of northwestern France this morning. The Ministry of Supply in London revealed that information just a short while ago. We've heard in the past months, almost now for in the past 2 years, the reports of German secret weapons. We've had a good deal of information about their rockets, about their glider bombs and their radio-controlled tanks, but we've had very little on the Allied side in the way of boasting of our magnificent weapons. I saw some of them in operation at the Anzio beachhead. They can't be talked about even now. And yet, even those weapons, as terrible as I saw them, have been superseded by even newer weapons, since this report says that many of the secret weapons were used for the first time by the liberating armies when they broke their way into northwestern France this morning to start the long-awaited liberation of the occupied countries in Europe. The news continues to come into the CBS newsroom. We will be standing by here to give you the latest reports as they come in. The latest report we have so far on the progress of the fighting is the announcement from Prime Minister Churchill that there have been penetrations of several miles. Radio France in Algiers broadcasts a statement by André Le Troquer, who is the French Commissioner for the Administration of Liberated Territories in metropolitan France, declaring that the liberation of France has started. Following is the text of the statement as broadcast to French areas and reported by the Federal Communications Commission. Events expected by the whole of the French people have finally taken place, says Mr. Le Troquer. Our hope becomes a reality. The liberation of France has started. In this most solemn hour of our history, we all have only one duty, total sacrifice for the motherland. French blood will flow again. Think of the sufferings that our brothers will have to endure to be finally liberated. Let us unite all our thoughts in the certainty that tomorrow France will be free and we shall make her greater and more beautiful than she has ever been. That report came from Algiers, the seat of the French Committee of National Liberation, and was made by André Le Troquer, the French Commissioner for the Administration of Liberated Territories in metropolitan France. Meanwhile, we received earlier today the news from London that General de Gaulle has arrived in England and evidently has already held consultations with the British authorities looking for the complete cooperation of the people inside France. What can we can expect in the way of cooperation and help from the French people must still remain a question mark. We do know that there are Frenchmen who have fought against the Germans underground for many, many months, for many years inside France. We will only have to wait now for time to see if all France rises to help us, and we feel sure that they will. These reports that we have just read you, eyewitness reports and the last-minute details of the news of the invasion, have just come into our newsroom and constitute the latest information that we have.
This is Columbia in New York. We're expecting momentarily to switch to London for the number 2 communique from Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces. We're informed it will be available shortly. Meanwhile, here is a summary of the news to this moment. Reporting the European invasion up to schedule, President Roosevelt announced today the loss of 2 United States destroyers and an LST, landing ship tanks, in the first push. These covered ships reported lost up to noon today, he told his news conference, adding aircraft losses were approximately 1%. A reporter asked the president whether the Tehran conference decided the place as well as the time for the invasion. Laughing, Mr. Roosevelt said, there were half a dozen places. Are there still half a dozen places? The president said the questioner knew his question was improper. Allied invasion forces drove 10 miles through the German Atlantic Wall defenses today and entered the communications center of Caen after seizing several key bridges in northern France. Constantly reinforced Allied armies, supported by the biggest air and sea armadas in history, plunged into Festung Europa at perhaps a dozen points along a widening front after apparently resting solid beachheads on the shores of the Normandy Peninsula. Paratroopers who spearheaded the initial landings were reported by the Nazi-controlled Paris radio to be dropping in great numbers north of Rouen, 40 miles from the coast. The Vichy radio told of great masses of Allied planes slashing at German defenses in the Calais and Dunkirk area and reported violent naval action thundering off the French coast in the narrowest part of the English Channel. Prime Minister Winston Churchill declared that American, British, and Canadian forces have penetrated several miles inland in some cases. Thus far, invasion losses have been unexpectedly light. The German radio admitted that Allied forces had seized a beachhead some 16 and a half miles long by a few miles deep in the Villers-sur-Mer Trouville area. The London radio stated that the invasion front in France was sufficiently broad by evening to be more than a bridgehead. As the invasion forces smashed ahead, Supreme Invasion Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower revealed that bad weather had postponed the invasion 24 hours from Monday to Tuesday morning. The general, summarizing the first day's operations, said that the gigantic Allied armies under Field Commander General Sir Bernard Montgomery had surmounted the first four or five obstacles. Surmounting of these obstacles was aided by an unprecedented bombardment of German coast defenses from the huge sea armada and by hordes of Allied bombers. Ferried across the English Channel by a great armada of 4,000 ships and thousands of lighter craft, and screened from above by a thundering fleet of 11,000 Allied warplanes, American, British, and Canadian troops hit the beaches along a front of roughly 100 miles between Cherbourg and Le Havre in the first cloudy hours of daylight and swept swiftly inland. Allied losses in the initial assault were much lighter than had been anticipated, and there was an unmistakable air of optimism at the headquarters of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander. It was disclosed that D-Day originally had been set for Monday, but bad weather forced a day's postponement. Tonight, a German news broadcast announced the Allies held a front from 10 to 15 miles broad along the Normandy coast and from a half mile to nearly a mile deep. Prime Minister Churchill announced that Allied airborne troops had captured several strategic bridges inside France before the enemy could destroy them, and that there is even fighting proceeding in the town of Caen. Caen is 9 miles inland, near the base of the Cherbourg Peninsula, west and slightly south of Le Havre. Airborne troops are well established, and the follow-ups are proceeding with very much less loss than we expected, Churchill told a cheering House of Commons in his second report of the day. Many dangers and difficulties, which this time last night appeared extremely formidable, are behind us. This operation is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. The German-controlled Paris radio broadcast a last-minute flash from the battlefield early tonight, saying that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. Rouen is 41 miles from the coast east of Le Havre. In an earlier report, Churchill told Commons that the Allied assault was proceeding according to plan. And what a plan! We hope to finish the enemy with a succession of surprises during the course of the fighting. We still expect the number two communique of the Allied invasion to be broadcast from London momentarily. While we're waiting for it, here is a further summary of the day's developments. Parachute and glider-borne troops, who led the history-making attack in thousands of pre-dawn landings deep within the enemy's vaunted defenses, suffered extremely small losses in the air, headquarters announced, and seaborne losses were described as very, very small. Nazi coastal defenses had been silenced until they offered only sporadic fire, and Allied air power completely dominated the battle area. Several of the toughest invasion hurdles had been successfully cleared, but an Allied spokesman warned that many more remain. Huge Allied reinforcements of men and armor were pouring ashore tonight. Fixed German guns along the coast were literally blown apart by a 10,000-ton aerial barrage in the 8 hours preceding the landings, and then a formidable fleet of American and British warships, including battleships with 16-inch rifles, stood close inshore and destroyed enemy bunkers and gun positions with point-blank fire. Despite a command by Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring that the invasion must be beaten off even if the Luftwaffe perishes, only 50 German planes appeared in the early hours of the attack. Allied fighters ranged 75 miles inland without meeting opposition. The German radio reported bitter fighting at a half dozen points in Normandy and claimed to have identified two U.S. airborne divisions in the Cherbourg Peninsula and two British airborne divisions in the Seine area near Le Havre. First to report that the invasion was underway early today, the Nazis speculated that the Normandy assault merely was diversionary in nature and declared the invasion troops were going into an inferno, comparison with which Dante's hell was child's play. The enemy broadcasters said German reinforcements were being rushed to meet the onslaught and that counterattacks already had been struck. Churchill, though his night report to Commons was extremely optimistic in the main, warned that the day's fighting gives no indication whatever of what may be the course of the battle in the next days and weeks, because the enemy will now probably endeavor to concentrate on this area. In that event, heavy fighting will soon begin and will continue. It is therefore a most serious time that we are entering upon. In addition to the heavy counterattacks expected to be launched by German ground troops within a matter of days or even hours, it also was anticipated that the Nazi Air Force would pitch violently into the battle soon. The Germans are estimated to have probably 1,750 fighters and 500 bombers available for the defense of the West. By comparison, the great Allied plane fleets which led the assault before dawn today extended across 200 miles of sky and used navigation lights to maintain formation. Headquarters tonight praised troop carriers of the 9th Air Force for having conducted very large-scale airborne operations with very small losses. "The sky was black with them as they headed for France," said an American fighter pilot. He said a thick overcast up to 7,000 feet might have contributed to keeping the German Air Force on the ground. Other airmen told of seeing Allied ground troops hit the beaches and literally run inland through the shattered enemy defenses. More than 640 Allied naval guns, ranging from 4 to 16 inches, participated in the pulverizing bombardment of the Atlantic Wall, the most photographed and publicized belt of defenses the world has ever known. Churchill said the Nazi shore batteries were largely quelled before an Allied soldier landed. Only a few enemy destroyers and motor torpedo boats attempted to interfere with the vast Allied fleet. Preceding the actual invasion fleet across the channel was a huge armada of little ships, minesweepers, which swept lanes straight to the designated landing points. The length of sweep wires used to tear loose the moored German mines stretched nearly 70 miles in all, the greatest minesweeping job in history. Some of the ships used still are on the secret list. After the sweepers, in amazingly ordered confusion, came the whole flat-bottomed family of landing craft, laden with fighting men, guns, tanks, shells, field rations, hypodermics, radio sets, bandages, trucks, and other bewildering baggage of combat. An Associated Press correspondent reported the morale of American troops was amazingly high as the invasion fleet prepared to move across the channel. "Most of them never have been in battle before," he wrote, "but their ranks are toughened by a hard core of veterans who learned to fight across the battlegrounds of the Mediterranean. The troops entered their ships at noon yesterday and then passed the hours reading, arguing, playing cards, or rolling dice." Eisenhower, after having personally inspected and wished luck to a unit of airborne troops, addressed a ringing message to all the Allied invasion forces in which he declared, "We will accept nothing less than full victory." Then, from a housetop somewhere on the English coast, the commander watched the great spectacle unfold. Leading all Allied ground troops in the invasion was General Sir Bernard L. Montgomery, Britain's most famed field commander, who whipped Marshal Erwin Rommel on the sands of Africa. He predicted 3 weeks ago that Rommel would try to knock us back into the sea. He described Rommel as a disruptor and forecast that to disrupt the invasion, he will try to hit us early. In a pre-battle message to his troops, Montgomery told them, "To us is given the honor of fighting a blow for freedom which will live in history, and in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doing. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. Good luck to each one of you, and good hunting on the mainland of Europe." Wielding sheath knives and Tommy guns, thousands of American and British paratroopers and glider troops swept down on sleeping Cherbourg Peninsula out of the pre-dawn blackness and immediately set about the tasks of disrupting Nazi rear lines by destroying key bridges, rail yards, and enemy strong points. At headquarters late today, a military spokesman praising troop carrier planes which navigated through a rainy, stormy night to drop thousands of these specially trained soldiers on vital objectives said, "The operation was on a very large scale and was carried out with great precision. Our losses in aircraft were extremely small. It was a fine job, very fine indeed." As the airborne troops are fighting fiercely well behind the enemy lines, the spokesman naturally was not in a position to give a detailed picture of the results of their landings. but reports from air observers indicated they carried the brunt of the battle in the early stages, creating large diversions and as much damage as possible. Attack bombers flying back over the area in which the airborne troops landed reported seeing a number of demolitions and many burning buildings. The German radio gave the first hint of the scope of this epochal operation. The broadcast claimed the soldiers had been identified as from four divisions, which were named as the 1st and 6th British and the 28th and 100th American. Allied military authorities withheld comment on the size of the landing force. Before taking off, these crack troops were wished Godspeed by Supreme Commander General Eisenhower, who spent 7 hours touring airdromes from which the air troops took off. After chatting with them and eating donuts and coffee at one of their headquarters, Eisenhower climbed to a roof and watched as squadron after squadron climbed into the sky, their destination France. A bulletin just received from Reuters News Agency says the U.S. 9th Air Force aircraft flew more than 2,500 individual missions before 1 p.m. today in the most violent 12 hours of aerial warfare in history. Preceding by minutes the first seaborne troops to cross the channel, 9th Air Force Marauder crews, briefed at 10 p.m. Eastern wartime, took off in the semi-darkness in a cold, driving rain to batter coastal defenses and gun emplacements on the French shore. 16 250-pound bombs each, and flying at altitudes down to 4,000 feet, the lowest level they have operated from in more than a year, the Marauders attacked their targets in 8 waves and left many of the guns out of action before the first assault of ground troops arrived. Associated Press war correspondent Gladwin Hill, flying in the landing area shortly after 6 a.m., reported that inland hundreds of parachutes, plopped neatly in fields without a sign of life about, testified eloquently to the alacrity with which their riders plunged into cover to tangle with Germans. The concentration of chutes in model landing places was cheering evidence of smoothness with which the operation came off. Later, Associated Press photographer Bede Irwin told of seeing thousands of red and dark green camouflage parachutes lying about on the ground during the flight across the Cherbourg Peninsula. There was also about a 500-acre section packed with gliders, he said. A number had cracked up, but most seemed to have gotten down okay. From our height, I couldn't see any ground movement, but many buildings in the area were burning. There must have been quite a battle. For this climactic moment, the spearheading airborne troops spent months in secret, arduous training. Besides ankle sheath knives and rapid-fire weapons, they carried bandoliers of ammunition, hand grenades, coils of rope, pick handles, spades, and rubber dinghies, the last in case of plane failure over the channel. Some of the paratroopers, looking like Indians on the warpath with their faces stained reddish-brown with cocoa and linseed oil, said that they had put on the camouflage so we'll have something to eat if our rations run out. The quip, told to Eisenhower, made the Supreme Commander laugh quite heartily. Normandy, whose broad beaches were chosen by the Allied commanders as offering the best chance of success, forms a natural peninsula, a pathway into France. The peninsula ranges from 25 to 60 miles wide and is 70 miles long, with the port of Cherbourg at its tip. Allied penetrations inland would clear all of Norway with its many airfield sites and provide a pathway down the Seine Valley to Paris. Le Havre, 100 airline miles northwest of Paris on the Seine River estuary, is France's second airport, with 14 ship basins and 8 miles of docks. The German DNB news agency said the invasion began with the dropping of major airborne formations between the estuaries of the Seine and the Orne in the area of Isigny, Caen, and near Barfleur, at the northeastern tip of the Cherbourg Peninsula. About 2 hours after the parachutists dropped, the German agency said large-scale amphibious operations began on a wide front between Le Havre and Cherbourg, with very strong disembarkations at the small coastal village of Saint-Vaast-la-Hogue. It said the landings were made behind thick blankets of artificial fog. We still are awaiting tonight's Allied communique on the progress of the invasion. The moment it's ready, we'll switch to London to hear this latest official news. Now here's the naval side of the invasion picture. The massed might of 4,000 Allied warships thundered a crashing prelude to invasion early today, spearing and blasting the German defenses along the west wall so the swarms of waiting landing craft could close in for the assault. British warships alone loosed a tornado of fire west of Le Havre, pouring 2,000 tons of shells every 10 minutes, with 600 ships firing everything from 4 to 16 inches, surprising and stunning shore batteries whose return fire was sporadic. Thousands of Allied bombers roared overhead. Fighter planes weaved in and out of the clouds, and dense black and gray smoke rolled from the beaches around Le Havre. The continuous thunder of broadsides and the crash of bombs filled the air, and great spurts of flame flared from the shore.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, And again, when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too. Strengthen our daily tasks. To redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travail, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President has just led the nation in prayer. We return you now to New York.
Columbia's news headquarters in New York, Bob Trout speaking. We've heard the prayer of the President of the United States, written by the President and broadcast by him from Washington. And now continuing Columbia's invasion coverage, in a few moments from our New York news headquarters, we shall hear from Quentin Reynolds, from William L. Shira, and from Major George Fielding Elliott. But first, we're going to switch to Great Britain, where our Columbia news staff has already been up half the night. It's past 4 a.m. in London right now, and we shall all certainly be on duty at our microphones for many hours to come.